Hi everybody, thanks for tuning in to the Leeds Book Club podcast. We're delighted to be joined today by Ross Young, the author of the Gloomwood series. The first book, Deadheads, is out at the moment on Amazon. Hi Ross, thank you very much for joining us.
That's okay, it's nice to speak to you.
So tell us a little bit about Gloomwood. This is a new world that you've created, and I believe that Deadheads is your first novel.
It is, yeah. I mean, Gloomwood is essentially, it's the afterlife, but who it's for and who's supposed to end up there varies. There's lots of reasons why people end up there, which I haven't alluded to too much in the first book. And essentially, it's full of a lot of different characters from different walks of life who essentially end up dying and then having to continue living in a twisted kind of way. And it's not the happiest place. Lots of people who end up there spending their time working in their dead-end jobs just to carry on existing rather than living. So when I think about it like that, it's horribly depressing, actually.
Well, I read something online. I don't know whether it was yourself or a review of the book, and they said Gloomwood, the town that makes you realise there's worse than death.
Yeah, I can't remember if it was me or someone else either, but it's definitely the case. There's a lot of the story that alludes to the fact that if somebody dies, how can they die again?
Yeah.
It's a question that I'm turning around a lot in my head, I suppose. And there's a lot of discussion of that in the novel. If somebody's dead, and obviously it is a crime novel, it's about a mystery, and murder is supposedly the most abhorrent crime that we can think of.
Yeah.
And we've got these people who are existing, how can they be murdered if they've already died?
And so I've
suggested that that's the end, they turn out of existence. But then we've got to wonder, what does a removal from existence actually mean? Could people even remember someone who was removed from existence? It's a personal one, and I think that's what got me thinking about it in the first place. Is everyone's always thinking about what comes next. I'm not a very religious person in the first place, which is probably quite apparent from the book.
There's a certain irreverence, yes.
And I suppose the question is, if someone dies and they're supposed to go to this afterlife, is it eternal? And if it's eternal, what sort of thing can happen there? And it's basically trying to put a event on the afterlife that makes it into what we already know and what we already experience from being alive. So, I mean, it sounds pseudo-intellectual when I put it like that, but really, it's just me messing around with a bunch of ideas.
It's a really interesting book because it's structured, as you say, as a sort of surreal whodunit, and you've got a motley crew of characters that are all working, you know, against the clock to try and solve a crime, and that's brilliant. But you've also managed to work in quite active descriptions of Gloomwood itself, so that the land that you're based in, I mean, Blunt has to as much navigate his new environment as he does the misdirection that he's being sent in by various potential bad guys. And I found that so interesting. The other thing that I thought just really added to it is the characters that populate Gloomwood are people, but they're also gods that nobody believes in, ideas and concepts like the world being flat. And I've never come across anything quite like it before, and the fact that they're all miserable, you know, it should have led to quite a one-note tone, but it's a very funny book.
I'm glad that you think so, and I mean, in that part with the gods and the hopes and dreams particularly, I thought there was something very sad about the fact that people have had these hopes and dreams and people believe in these things, and then they stop. And I thought, I mean, it is crushingly sad to think of these things that have died and have never been alive in the first place.
Yeah.
We have taken on a physical form. And basically all they've got is the fact that they were never alive. And now that they are alive, nobody gives a monkey's about them.
I thought that epitomised so perfectly in that policeman who's all but given up hope.
Yeah. Blunt's a good character and he's a fun character to write because he was miserable as hell when he was alive. You know, he was a mess as it was, and he died, and he's been given an opportunity to do something useful, have a purpose, which is something he's lacking in life for so long. But but he's dead, and he's no one's going to be jumping up and down about the fact that they've just died.
Yeah.
So give that to somebody who's incredibly miserable as it is. It was quite interesting because, it's a sarcastic, nasty piece of work at the end of the day. But I actually quite like him. I really like the guy, which is something that shouldn't happen. So I suppose he's not really an anti-hero, but he fits. He's not your typical leading character, I don't think.
No.
Though he does fit a lot of the stereotypes of the downtrodden detective at the same time.
He's a joy to read because, as you say, I think he turns a lot of those stereotypes on his head. You know, he's not Sam Spade. He's not stoically continuing on despite all of this crap that's happening. He's a miserable moaner and he's quite happy to whinge at the drop of a hat. And yet I really like him. Nothing about this character is likeable except for everything.
Yeah, I'm really glad you think so because that was the aim. And the kind of, as you said, Sam Spade character and these stoic types and this kind of modern-day Jack Reacher characters that you've got, like that, who are just, at the end, they're going to fight through because of what they believe in and all this kind of stuff. And it just doesn't really ring true. And I think it's a joy to read. I like reading things like that. I genuinely do. But I think that it's nice to see someone who's doing it because they have to. He hasn't really got a lot of choice.
Yeah, it's not like he's being noble.
No, that's it. There's no nobility in him. He isn't doing it because he thinks that's what's right, that's what's best for everyone. He does it because he feels the need to trudge towards the end of things so that they'll be over. That seems to be the there's certainly the impression that I got. It's a funny thing when you're writing a character because they come to life as you're writing them, and I didn't sit down and think, right, I'm going to make Blunt into this horrible, miserable sort who doesn't want to do anything. It kind of falls into place when you think about them more, and it just begins. You get realizations about the character, and just think, wow, it's very strange. It's not the kind of character that I probably would have set out to write in the first place. And he ends up.
Hello. Sorry, I lost you for a second there. Could you repeat that?
Uh-oh. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. I just lost you after you were saying that it wasn't necessarily the character you set out to write.
No, not at all. And I think I probably would have gone more for one of those stereotypical characters, but Blunt led me down his path, if you like, and you end up writing the character that the character should be. Not a character that you want them to be. I think that's quite important.
But,
it wouldn't work otherwise.
Yeah, I quite like the fact that once he's dead, and I've said in my review, there's something so delightful about watching somebody who's been hit by every branch of the tree in life and then dies and discovers that he has to do it again. But his character does evolve, and I think it's most obvious in his interactions with Ralph and Sarah. He in a weird way he brings out the best in Ralph. I don't think Mortimer would want to see it like that, but he orders him and he makes him think and he makes him react. But Sarah brings out the best in Blunt because she's intangible, and I think he is a little bit sensitive to her state. You know, she changes him. She makes him a little bit less of a douche, I think.
Yeah, that's a fair way to put it. I think that there's certainly the fact that she is disappearing all the time and not all there. I think for Blunt, it's quite a thing because he does think very little of himself.
Yeah.
And that's something that's quite crucial to his character. He doesn't rate himself particularly well in any aspect of his life.
Yeah.
But to see someone who's at an even worse position than he is, it makes him think. And I think that because in life he was so miserable for so long, to be around people who are actually interacting with him, because the idea that I was trying to put across is that he's an incredibly lonely person.
Yeah.
Until he died. And although he thinks it's all much worse, all of a sudden there are these people that he has to interact with, and he has to do something with those people.
Yeah.
He can't just lock them away. He's not in a position where he can just look after himself. He's got no idea what's going on. He's completely lost. So he relies on them.
And it's quite, I think that's quite a powerful aspect to it, that it's genuinely a rehabilitative society, because I mean the police up until this point are just thugs for hire, you know. There's no actual discipline or rule of law. But with Blunt, he's faced that once he catches the culprit, what do you do with it then? As you say, it's not like you can punish them. It's not like you can kill them. You know, he can't put them on death row. And particularly in this book, as we start to unravel some of the layers, you begin to realize that the motivations of the not so newly dead are totally different from living characters.
And that's one of the most fun things to play with. I mean, writing the book was a lot of fun at the end there, because I'm getting to play with lots of ideas that I don't often get to read about. And I know that sounds strange, but writing the book, and I've written for a long time, but writing this one was me saying, right, well, I haven't read about these ideas, and I want to explore what happened with them. And it's very difficult to think of the motivations of somebody who isn't alive, because all of our motivations at the base level
are
are
about
to do with,
survival.
yeah, exactly, and we have a limited time, and the people in Gloomwood don't. And I think that's something that is, it's getting more and more difficult, to be honest, to think how would that affect you if you, they're not immortal, because they're already dead. And time, they've got forever, so it's quite a bit of a I don't know what you feel about language, but I know what I would use there to describe that.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's quite messed up.
It's a bit fucked up. Yeah, we put language warnings on all of our podcasts. Speak away. One of my favorite things in it, and it happens relatively early on in the book, is you provide the Grim Reaper with a backstory. You've come up with what has become my definitive version of why the Grim Reaper looks the way he does, what happened to him, how that works. I mean, I read it. I think I must have read it about three times before I could continue to the rest of the chapter. It's just such a perfect little moment. How did something like that come about? What's it like taking on, you know, death and making him your own?
I mean, although it might seem odd, I'm a scientist at heart. So I looked at the character and thought, well, how could he get here in the first place? And it was a matter of taking steps backwards to see where he could come from. And it was great fun, and you're not the first person to say that either about that part, because he's this terrifying figure in a lot of fiction, who's so unknown that it just adds to the mythos around him. And then the Grim Reaper in Gloomwood isn't the same as you might find elsewhere. He's not quite as ominous. And I wanted him to become more human. And to do that, I had to explain where he came from in the first place. And it wasn't easy. And I went backwards and forwards quite a few times about how. And that draws everyone from the book. It just kind of came together, and I don't really know why. I think maybe I spent too long thinking about where the Grim Reaper came from at the end of it altogether. But I did enjoy that. It's something that's, again, it just leads to the fact that you're trying to create something completely different. And I wanted to remove myself as much as possible from past incarnations of death as a being. And I think that it's quite difficult, because we all have this picture of death in our heads. And he does look the same as we imagine, but there's something far more flawed about him in the Gloomwood series than there is in others. And the important thing for me was, he's just a person.
Yeah.
He looks terrifying, but he was just a person who did something amazing. But he's got to live with that, or be dead with that, even, forever now. And there's going to be a lot more coming up about the Grim Reaper, and I'm hoping to explore him quite a lot more, because I think that he's probably the most interesting character when you start to think about what he's done and where he's come. There's certainly a lot there, and there's a lot of questions about what does he really do. He's essentially a figurehead, but it doesn't appear to do anything ever except be scary. And it turns out that he's not particularly scary. I mean, I love the fact that in his office he's got model cats and things everywhere, and it's like an old knitting lady's room. He's just not quite right, and that's the point. He's not really anything that people want him to be.
Yeah.
And it's quite interesting. But his backstory was essentially, it wasn't just his, it had to be a creation story for the whole of Bloomwood as well.
Yeah.
Because they worked hand in hand. And I did enjoy that. And it is crucial that that worked. If that didn't work, the whole thing would fall apart, I think.
I think you're right. Not because the story is not strong in its own way, but it was the first time you took on a cultural moor in your writing. And I think that if it hadn't, you know, if it hadn't come together quite as well as it did, it'd leave the reader a little hesitant. Oh God, is that all they could come up with for that? Whereas instead, you got to that point, and I was doing that thing where I was tapping my feet against the floor, kind of going, "Oh my God!" You know. For one thing, the Grim Reaper has a human origin story, which a lot of us, you know, that's not something we're led to believe. But there was another sort of counterintuitive character as well called Petal, who looks like a brick shithouse and is blue, I seem to recall, but
yeah,
is incredibly compassionate and very honest. And he appears throughout the book, and you're never really given any sort of sense of what's going on there, but I found him very interesting, and I believe he's going to be in the next one as well.
Yes, he plays a bigger part in the next one, which is, there's a little hint dropped at the end of this one about, basically, it does follow on. I tried to make them as separate as possible, but it follows on because it's fun to drop a teaser in.
Yeah.
As to what's coming, and it's a lot more focused on Petal, who I think is a very interesting character. I mean, it's not really revealed to us what exactly happened in the past, and there's obviously something to his relationship with Johnson.
Yeah.
Who spent his time with, and there's obviously something more than just a friendship there, but we don't know where that came from. And we don't know why he's again a scary guy, but obviously only externally. And that's going to be quite interesting to explore that in further detail. Like I say, quite interesting, but it's been written. It's just taken some time to be polished, if you like, to the stage that I want it to be. It's very difficult when you're writing something like this to be happy with it. And there's also a lot of nuances that are involved in dealing with something that is so fictional.
Mm-hmm.
I know that sounds odd, but you're constantly thinking, does that make sense to what's going to come next and what's going to come before? And having written stuff in the past, not that I've published anything like that, it's set more in the real world.
Yeah.
Being consistent is a little bit easier, because it's just some little things, like in the real world, you know that a bus is a bus.
Yeah.
But in Gloomwood, you don't know that a bus is a bus. It could be anything. It could be a seven-tentacled monster that carries people on its back. It isn't, but it could be something as strange as that.
Yeah.
And you've got it all the time. It's not a matter of walking into a shop and buying something for your character. It's a matter of traversing what is Gloomwood and how are things different, because that's what's the most interesting thing to do. And I write in very short chapters, which I think comes from the crime element of it, but writing those very short chapters means that I can drop in things about Gloomwood works, and it doesn't disrupt from the flow. There's things like, I mean, one of my favourite characters, and after I'd finished the book, I was quite disappointed that I'd given him such a small role, was the guy who was the thought that the world was flat.
Yes, because I really liked him.
Yeah, I did, and I thought after I'd written him and I finished the book, I was a bit saddened that he had such a tiny role, so I might have to go back and find him and find something to do, because he was very odd, and he was a very good representation of what people end up like in Gloomwood.
Mm.
Because he went from being a thought that the entire globe at one point
shared,
it wasn't a globe, thought about, and now he's doing taxi runs from the airport or the death port into the city. It's a bit of a fall from grace for him.
Bit of a downslide, so, yeah.
Yeah, it's very strange. But Petal's definitely coming back in. I like Petal a lot.
You've created a scenario where, because it's weird and wacky and wild, any of the inhabitants could probably carry their own story, because any of the inhabitants will have a backstory that's beyond anything that we as the living have experienced. But I do hope that Blunt is back. I hope that that we get more stories with him in it, just because I really like him. The big bastard.
He's a bastard that he is likeable. He's never going to be let alone, because he is too interesting, and he is a reasonable representation in Gloomwood of an everyman character.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. I mean, there's a recurring problem in fiction, and particularly in the kind of indie fiction that is written, where people want to write, and I think that it stems from a lack of experience. People want to write about themselves into a novel, and so they come up with those characters. They call them
Mary Sue's, isn't it?
Mary Sue, is it?
Yeah.
And because I read quite a lot of indie fiction, because I want to get an idea of what else is out there, I'm quite often put off by that. And I think that it's one of the issues with writing now, with the big boom of all the Amazon stuff and Smashwords and all these things where you can release a book at the end of the day, with little or no protection from anybody else, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And you've got people who are putting things out there next to works that are very good, that are unfortunately not very good. They're not up to the same standard.
Yeah.
And it's this recurring problem. And I was thinking about this quite a lot. And I think that it's going to affect people quite badly, and it already is affecting people quite badly. You put a lot of time and effort into something, and it's unfortunately not being told by enough people that they need to work on it more.
Yeah.
And that's one of my biggest fears. It's just why the second novel in the series is still sitting there waiting, because you don't have that support behind you to release it, and think, yes, okay, it is good enough. I've got the opinions of all these people, because there is always a question mark of, well, what would I say to somebody who'd show me their work?
Yeah.
Where would you be that brutally honest with somebody who's put all that time and effort into it? And would it be unfair? It's the whole world that we live in at the moment. For me, it bothers me a lot, because you see it. It's the whole X Factor kid generation as well. Who's going to tell them that they shouldn't go on television in the first place? And then you've got the same with the music industry in general. Lots of people are releasing music online everywhere, and it's become such a massive marketplace. But I think that getting voices heard is difficult, which is why this whole Mary Sue thing, why Blunt was so important to me as the central character of this book. He had to be removed from any of that associations whatsoever. So I suppose he was, in some ways, he was always going to end up being a nasty shit at the end.
We can't make it too easy for him.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, tell us a little bit about your writing style. I mean, you said that you've been writing on and off for years, but it's not your primary job. I mean, is it a case of discipline, of just sitting down and getting the words out, or is it a case of compulsion? You have the story in your head and you need to get it down on a page.
Well, for me, it's definitely a compulsion. If it was discipline, then I reckon I would have got a lot more writing done. it's a need at the end of the day. I mean, I spend a lot of time daydreaming and thinking about things and stuff like that, and questions like those that I've written about in the Gloomwood series are ones that I will sit and ponder, and they're not always the questions that you would bring up in normal conversation. You know, what would happen if somebody already dead died is not something that I would ask them without breakfast. Yeah. You know?
Do you think it hurt the Grim Reaper? What?
Writing for me has always been something that I really enjoy doing, and it's quite, I think that a lot of people find it very therapeutic in a way to just bash out a story and just say, right, okay, so now I know what happens. And that's certainly how it works in some ways with me. It's a discussion of a thought that I've had, and then what the hell happens, I need to know. And because it's not a thought that everyone else is having, I need to find out, and the way to do that for me is to write and find out what would happen, how does it work.
In the absence of empirical evidence, you will create your own origin stories.
That's it, yeah. This book scared me when I was writing it, because I was like, am I stepping over a dangerous mark? I mean, fortunately, it's written with very tongue-in-cheek, and it's supposed to be humorous.
Mm.
But if it had been written seriously or with too much... how would I put it? With a little bit too much emphasis on where everyone's coming from and stuff like that behind it, would I be attempting to create a religion? I know that sounds ridiculous, but you get very paranoid when you spend so much time writing something, and then you start to think, well, what would a certain person I know think about just the ideas, not having read it, just the idea? There are some people who might be quite upset, and then And that's quite awkward as well, and that comes a lot. I think that's why a lot of people who write for themselves in the first place as a compulsion to get ideas out without going and asking very strange questions of people that don't have answers. So it's kind of a philosophical thing, I suppose. Of writing is a release for most people. It certainly is for me. It's a release of ideas and thoughts, particularly the weirder ones. To get them out on into a physical form of a sort of a digital form as it is.
Yeah.
And have a think about them. So I have been writing a very long time, but it's always been, I think, that's been at the core of it. I want to know what happens, where this comes from. So it's selfish. It is entirely selfish. I'm a very selfish person.
That should be your logo.
Read my book. I'm an incredibly selfish person.
That would be quite a blunt way of going about and selling yourself, wouldn't it? You know,
yeah.
Hire me. I'm the only one who gives less of a shit than you.
Yeah, that's it. Well, sadly, I think that's what a lot of people who write are probably afraid to admit. It's very self-indulgent. And some people make the mistake of being too self-indulgent, and then it becomes a problem. But it is a self-indulgent process. How can it not be? You're doing it by yourself.
Well,
and repeat.
I suppose to a certain extent I can see, you know, a certain element of self-indulgence. But I also think, sometimes, and I think it's definitely happened in the case of Deadheads, these things take on a life of their own. I mean, throughout our conversation, I think I was the one that started it. I've just automatically assumed that it was a series. I was very relieved when I got to the end of the book to see, although I think it's a very bold move to announce your next book while I presume you're still writing it. But I was relieved to see that there'd be more. And I think when I'm listening to you talk, you're very confident in the world in your head. You know, you see the geography to it, you're working out the rules for it. And sometimes when stuff gets like that, you just have to get it out. You have to share the story because you'll never get to talk to about it with anybody otherwise.
That's exactly it. And that's the best thing about speaking to someone who has read the book and it's happened quite a lot when I went back to the UK and saw people who had asked to read the book, who had questions. And sometimes I didn't have an answer, which is brilliant for me because that's really exciting because then I have to think about, well, what is the answer? But there must be one. There's not just an emptiness there. It's not just a blank. It's not something I'm going to shy away from.
I'll get to it for book 7.
That's it. You'll find out sometime, hopefully before I run out of words.
Because I know a lot of us that have, you know, put comments up on Amazon, which I very rarely do, but I really enjoyed reading it. But I noticed that a lot of us are kind of going, one thing, where's the food coming from?
Yeah, that one, that is actually going to be a whole novel based on that one. And the question should be, why does nobody ever ask? Because Blunt doesn't ask that question when he sat there in that cafe with Mortimer. And they're eating. He's confused as it is, but he doesn't say where does the food come from in the first place. And I don't know if people want to know the answer as well as the other thing because it's not pleasant. And that's all I'm saying.
Oh, I've gone to a Soylent Green place.
No, it's not. It's not quite there.
And that's our first spoiler so far of the interview, ladies and gentlemen.
That's all I'm giving away. I'm staying very tight there. I have to, otherwise I can't stick to the ideas.
So you're an independent author, by which I presume you mean you're self-publishing.
Yes, I do. I mean, I don't shy away from that self-publishing either. I don't think people should anymore. I know that it has a stigmatism attached to it, but now there's so much out there that is self-published, and a lot of it is worth, despite what I was saying earlier about some of it not being great, a lot of it is worth people's time and effort. And when we look at the fact that it's so hard, there's so many more of us, I know this sounds a little thing to say, there's so many more of us out there writing.
Yeah.
And there's not so many more publishers all of a sudden. There's not a huge amount of new books going out there at the same time. And you have authors who then they have got a crushing grip on their market and brilliant because their work is fantastic.
Yeah.
But why would the publishing house turn around and go, oh, well, you know, this sounds different, let's go. give it a go. It's not worth that investment.
Yeah, well, I mean, I found it very interesting, the case, though, a few months ago when J.K. Rowling was revealed to have written a novel and done a small print of it, you know, and it was getting some good critical commentary, but it not really gaining any traction. And then obviously it was slipped that it was her, and suddenly it's gone straight to the number one. People were very cynical about why she had done this. Was it all just ultimately a big PR scam and that kind of thing? But I think that there was a returning to roots. You know, you actually want to see, get genuine feedback, and indie publishing, self-publishing, and in the case of very big authors, I suppose anonymous publishing gives that opportunity.
I do, and I can imagine, I'd love to be in a position one day to have to publish anonymously to see if my writing was still up to scratch. That's about how I get there. But in the case of J.K. Rowling, part of me thinks, yes, it was all a PR scam, etc., etc., but I felt quite sorry for her in some ways, because she'd written a book that was very good. People didn't know it was her. She was getting good reviews for it, but she was hitting the same roadblock that everybody else who was starting out in publishing hits. And I mean, she already had to hit that once already when she did the Harry Potter novels.
Yeah.
As soon as her name came out that she'd written it, it became massively successful. I mean, what must that feel like as an author? It was a great book, but it wasn't really getting the sales that we wanted it to get.
Yeah.
The place it was hitting. So did she make the decision to reveal that? I mean, I would be surprised if she made that decision.
Well, I gather lawyers are involved, and it seems to be becoming more and more clear that she did not have any part to play any part in it. But I felt awful for her, because that, in a way, that's all she can do to maintain her integrity, is to try and try and release things and get honest feedback without people necessarily copying onto it being her. Where I think that self-publishing runs into a bit of a block is that without a publishing house, you know, without the marketing, without the PR, you can have the best little gem of a story and not be able to convince anyone to read it. I think that must be, you know, I know you're active on social media. How important is it for you to be able to engage with the people you want to read your book?
I like doing it, but I'm very typically British and polite about things, so I find it quite awkward asking people to read my book, and it's quite pathetic, and it's a poor personality trait. But at the end of the day, writers who are good marketers are a lot fewer than, I think, those people who are good marketers who've written something.
Yeah.
So that's hard, right? But I think that it's probably a lot easier if you're good at marketing to get lots of sales to your book, regardless of the writing that's involved there, because it does seem to be there's a certain barrier you have to get over, and having the book out available, it's available all over the place at the end of the day. It's available at nearly every ebook store that you can get to, and that didn't require a great amount of effort on my part, other than things formatting techie things, which I'm normally okay with.
Yeah.
But not everyone is. But the marketing side of things, embarrassingly, I've worked in marketing and things before as well, but it's very difficult when it's something that's so personal to people. You should read this, it's really good. And they go, well, did you write it? Yes. Well, I'm not going to say it's rubbish, am I? And then the time that's invested, my biggest bugbear is people who've written books or short stories, and that's a different thing, actually. But people who've written books and put them online and then practically hunt down people to read their book. And you're asking for some people, a very big investment in time to read a book. It's not a single, you know what I mean? It's not a music single. It's not 3-4 minutes of your time.
Yeah.
It can be days for some people to read through a book. And that's a massive investment that you're asking of people. I mean, people are employed to do things like that, and I think that's the hardest thing. So it has to be an unknown author who has very little in the way of publicity, doesn't have a publishing house behind them, so lacks that, its legitimacy, that the publishing house. To ask someone to invest their time in that and their money in that is a very big ask.
Yeah.
And it's a very sad thing, because it has to be that way. And I think that in reality there was a short window there for people in indie publishing to do quite well. And then there's a lot of underhand tactics now involved, which are every now and again you hear a story about someone who paid
lost you there for a second?
This morning I tried to set up the internet.
Right, sorry about that, everybody. We had a brief hiccup there with the Skype connection. But we were just talking about, you know, about self-publishing and getting your work out there and the mix between writing and marketing. And presumably it takes you a considerable period of time to write. How long did it take you to write Deadheads? Or to have a working rough draft?
Honestly, it took me 4 years.
Get Ted... Dead?
Get Ted Dead, I gave myself... Well, it took me 4 years to write Dead Heads because it was the building of a world in the first place, I think. And it actually had a few earlier incarnations which will be buried and never revealed to the light of day. But Get Ted Dead has probably taken me about a year to get to this point. And I don't know if I'm happy with it yet, which is a thing about self-publishing, I suppose, is that you are primarily the person who judges whether or not it's ready to go.
Yeah.
And it's a very hard thing to do. Especially as I think that you don't have... The added pressure has to be put on by yourself. You do not have a publishing house who are going, this book was supposed to be with us a month ago.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. And it has to fit around everything else you're doing. It's not like I can afford to stop working in order to write. Which would be great, but it's not an option. So there's a whole host of disadvantages to self-publishing that are out there. But at the same time, it's a medium to get your work to other people. So if you can't do it,
why not?
Why not? And I would certainly suggest people don't do it if you ever hope to make any living from it in any way. It's unrealistic, and it's one of those things that's held up as a possibility by people who want you to get into it, who want you to put your time and effort into it. It's not realistic. I'm quite happy with that, and I was always happy about that. You know what I mean? I didn't do any of that in order to sell copies of the book, although it sounds silly. It was to have it available to people and to get feedback on it. I wanted people's opinions.
Yeah. Now that you're a book published and another book on the way, when you look back at the process of getting Deadheads from working draft, final edit, you know, self-publishing it, what lessons have you learned? What are the bits of advice that you'd give yourself for book two?
Firstly, don't say you're bringing out the second book.
Until you've written it.
Yeah. That was really, really stupid. That's the biggest daft move I think that I've made. Also, it doesn't matter when you book. I released mine on New Year's Day of this year, if I remember rightly, thinking little ideas like, well, it's just after Christmas, everyone will have got new Kindles and things like that, it's New Year's Day, most people in the UK are probably going to be hungover, sitting at home looking for something to do, so it's a good time to put it out there. But there are about, I don't know, 50,000 other people with exactly the same thought process. And the simple fact is that what I think people need to do before they get anywhere near releasing their book, and I must admit that I won't do this. I know that already I won't do this, but it's what people should do. So it's a do as I say, not as I do point. But is you need to build up some kind of base of, well, not, I don't like the word followers, but of people waiting to get their hands on this. You need to get your book out there to people in the first place and get it reviewed. People like yourself who are prepared to invest their time in something in the hope that it won't be a waste of your time. And what we really need is a lot more people like yourself who are prepared to take a gamble on something they haven't heard of before and just see whether it's there or not. So the pitfalls otherwise, it takes a lot more time than people think to format and get books ready for publication. And if you're not particularly techie, then I'd suggest you find someone who is, or even pay some money to have it done. And I don't like saying that because I don't think that you should have to pay out anything really unless you want to.
But for the sake of a format, the war was lost. You know, it's I think that's one of the real It's a real hiccup within self-publishing is the lack of quality controls. You know, even within your own book, there were and it's difficult because you're creating a world where grammar and tenses are by nature very tricky things, but there are still the odd phrase that, you know, you'd sort of roll it on your tongue and go, I'm not sure if that's exactly how it is, but that's they're few and far between. In other, you know, in other indie in another indie book, sometimes you're reading them and they're riddled with spelling errors, and you're just sort of thinking, no matter how good the story is, if it's painful to read, somebody'll stop, you know, and not everybody is obsessed like me and has to get to the end of a book. You know, people will put it down if the.
Well, myself, and I'm guilty of those things as well. I am completely, and I'm quite happy to that there are errors in dead heads that I need to go through and fix yet again. And that's one of the bonuses of self-publishing. But if you've got a massive market already out there of people who've already read your book and those mistakes are glaring, there was one that I read recently whose main character changed name, and more embarrassingly still, it changed their name to the author's name.
Oh, God.
Which was horrific, and sadly, I just couldn't bear to continue reading. And that kind of mistake, which is a slip, it's a slip. It reveals a lot about what the author's
It
doing.
really does, though, doesn't it?
It does, and that's it's quite crushing as someone who's published their work in the same way to come across things like that, because it is a reflection on that's a reflection on Deadheads, although it's not Deadheads, someone else's book. It
No,
is a reflection.
it impinges on the reputation of it as a whole. You know, it's I suppose it's like anything. There's so much shit out there. There are sometimes people who avoid the farm altogether rather than have to wade through it to get to the good stuff, you know?
That's a wonderful way to put it, actually. That's a fantastic way to put it. It's very true. That is the case, and I think that
Oh no.
the point. Unfortunately, we did cut out because I was ranting by the end of that.
Oh no, that's a shame. That would have been good.
But essentially, my point is that people who are going to self-publish their books should never really expect the success that they might originally have placed on their book being published through a publishing house. It's not going to happen. And I think that if the reality of it came home to a few more people, I think that the market might thin a little bit, which would help the people who are not concerned with the need to make money or seek fame in the same way. And that it would be great if people could walk around saying, avoid self-publishing unless you know you're not going to get anything out of it, which is the sad truth. I think that I published Deadheads in the hope that some people would read it. I didn't publish Deadheads in the hope that millions of people would read it. It's just unrealistic, and it's the unfortunate truth, I suppose. It's unrealistic to think that's going to happen. It's a pipe dream, and what nobody should be thinking that, sadly, that they've written the next big thing, because it doesn't. It sounds really horrible. It sounds like I'm basically saying, don't hope for these things. But I
No,
think
you're
that.
saying let your hope be grounded.
Yeah, if you like. And I think that obviously I'm quite active with other writing websites online and stuff like that, and talking to people about what they've done and reading other people's writing that they haven't published and trying to help them or give them ideas and avoid the sniping that goes on, which is always good fun. But I think that a lot of that is filled with people who are writing the next Twilight,
Yeah,
next
50 Shades.
50 Shades is a big one, and a frustrating one, because surprisingly how often I search for Deadheads and end up with a page full of erotica.
Oh God, in Gloomwood, that would not be pretty.
No, and a subject I've avoided so far in Gloomwood as well.
And we are grateful for that.
Yeah, I don't think anyone wants that to come out. But it all stems from the same thing, which is now it's an open market for everybody.
Oh, you know what? You're going to have to, though, because now I really want to know, is it still necrophilia if both partners are dead?
See, that's the question.
See, now,
I don't.
that's going to bother me until you write it.
But what's even weirder is that you can have all your body parts changed and replaced.
Yeah, but you wouldn't be doing that during.
Well, not during.
Oh,
You have some somebody's appendage, the next week you have somebody else's. What does that mean?
Okay, I like to think that we've just gotten as gross as we're going to.
Maybe we'll put an end to that now. But it doesn't make sense. anyway.
Okay, for one moment, I want you to forget that you're self-deprecating and dry and British. You've got two sentences. Sell your book to the listening audience.
Okay, you will not have read anything like Deadheads before. And pick it up and it will make you laugh. It probably won't make you cry, but it will definitely make you laugh. And it is a fantastic adventure. And I am a genius. You must read it.
Okay, well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm very excited about Get Ted Dead. And although I can't entirely remember who Ted is, from you said he's in the first one. I'm like, really? I missed him, I think.
A tiny bit. The last chapter, I think.
Oh, I don't feel so bad then. I was on an emotional roller coaster at that point. You know, I'll have to go back and dig it out. But I'm really looking forward to reading it, and hopefully I'll be able to have a quick look at that once it comes out.
Definitely, it'll be going straight to you as soon as it comes out.
First, huzzah! The internet works again. Right, well, thank you so much, and to all of our listeners, thank you very much for downloading this. Obviously, this will be up on iTunes and the website.